Reese's peanut butter cups are the greatest, but let me play devil's advocate here. Let's see. So, no, that's a good thing. that's definitely not a problem. Reese's, you did it. You stumped this charming devil.
You haven't heard about the McCrispy yet. Well, then, you probably haven't heard the sweet silence after the first crispy bite either. Go try it for yourself to hear the best not sound you've ever heard.
Greetings. Welcome to the NASCAR on NBC podcast. I'm your host, Nate Ryan. Saturday night at Richmond Raceway will mark 20 years since the September 11th terrorist attacks, a tragedy that transformed the country and also had a major impact on NASCAR. The Twin Towers fell 3 days after the Cup Series had raced at Richmond, and it would be nearly 2 weeks until the green flag would wave again at Dover International Speedway. NASCAR and NBC will remember September 11th in a feature narrated by Tim Layden that will include interviews with NASCAR Vice Chairman Mike Helton and Dale Earnhardt Jr., whose victory at Dover had some referring to him as the faith healer of the Cup Series in 2001. Dover came barely 3 months after Earnhardt Jr. had won at Daytona in the first race at that track since his seven-time champion father was killed on the last lap of the Daytona 500.
This is undoubtedly one of the toughest announcements that I've ever personally had to make. But after the accident in turn four at the end of the Daytona 500, we've lost Dale Earnhardt.
That immeasurable loss of a Hall of Fame icon made the 2001 season already exhausting for NASCAR, which spent months answering questions about its safety record. Earnhardt's crash was the fourth fatality in less than 10 months across NASCAR's top three national series, and a voluminous and unprecedented blow-by-blow account of what caused the number three's accident was released in August after 6 months of painstaking study. Less than a month later, the withering reverberations of Earnhardt's death still were being felt within NASCAR when September 11th struck. With complete oversight of running the day-to-day operations at NASCAR as president, Helton was at the center of both maelstroms. This special episode of the NASCAR and NBC podcast will feature the full version of a 26-minute sit-down interview with Helton in Daytona Beach, some snippets of which also are part of the September 11th feature you can watch on Saturday night's pre-race show on NBCSN and online at NBCSports.com and the Motorsports on NBC YouTube channel. We'll begin the podcast with Helton explaining how taxing the 2001 season already had been for NASCAR since February 18th, 2001.
So after February, we spent most of the year working, trying to figure out what happened with Dale Sr. And so it was consumed while we were running a regular season and moving things on as we should. There was a lot of effort going on behind the scenes and trying to we told the industry and the world that we would find the best answers we could, and that took us most of that season. And I think it was late August, August 23rd or somewhere in there, that we announced publicly, after having shared it with the industry, the findings of the accident in February and the best answers we could get with the best science and the best people working on it and everything. So the whole season, in some sense, is kind of a blur at the racetrack because we were doing so many things behind the scenes trying to get that right. You know, just had completed that late August. I think the healing was going on along with the process of getting answers, but certainly the answers, I think, helped the healing process. And other moments in the 01 season, Dale Jr. winning down here in the summer race, those types of things, I think, helped the healing process. But there was a milestone for us to have completed that and said, you know, here's all we know. Here's what we know. And here's how we found out about it. And here's the scientists that helped us figure it out the best we could. And I remember the doctors and the different folks that were helping us try to figure out the engineers, the science behind it, that a lot of them used the term a perfect storm sometimes. When 9/11 unfolded, that's one of the first things that popped into my head. I said, here again is another set of incredibly either connected or disconnected circumstances that led to a perfect storm.
When the first plane hit the North Tower of the World Trade Center in Manhattan, Mike Helton was in his office in Daytona Beach.
The office I had here then had three televisions on my right-hand side on the wall. One of them I kept on the Weather Channel, one of them I kept on a sports channel, and the other one I kept on a news channel. And I was actually on the phone with a gentleman out of Washington, D.C., and we were talking, and he was watching. I think he was still at home, and he was watching it, and he said, "You just see what happened on TV?" And I said, "No." And so I was turning, and we wrapped up the conversation, and I turned and put all three channels on news and began to watch the day unfold. My first impression, his first impression was, is, oh my gosh, somebody accidentally hit a skyscraper in New York with an airplane, and then it didn't take long to figure out that it wasn't an accident. Shock's probably part of it, anger. When you realize that these were not accidents. And I'm not sure how to exactly put it into words, but sometimes you see things that just seem like they're not possible. You see it unfold and say, well, that couldn't have happened. That's not real. What if, you know, it's surreal that you even saw something like that. And then as they start covering it and then they validate the authenticity of it, and you realize what you saw was real, then I think that's when the shock gets deeper, the anger gets deeper, and that day had a lot of that going on.
Helton relocated to NASCAR chairman Bill France Jr.'s office, which became a quasi-command center as NASCAR's ruling family gathered information and insight about what was happening.
Well, and it was pretty quick. I mean, Bill, Jim, Brian, myself, we all kind of started having one-on-one conversations, but very quickly moved to Bill Jr.'s office, and we were all there at one spot and continuing to follow the information on what happened. And then also wondering, I says, oh gosh, okay, this happened in New York, this happened at the Pentagon, this happened in Pennsylvania, waiting for what happens next. And then you hear a lot of things that could been happening, and then they validate that, no, it wasn't, that was something else. And you were kind of waiting for something else, and fortunately, it kind of as it kind of wrapped up. But you're not confident that it's not over. But we were all in a room together talking about what was unfolding, and those types of conversations before we got into the reality of, okay, now what do we do around it? The day unfolds with a lot of unknowns. But also, as time goes, you're collecting more and more information about what happened. And the reality of all of that starts to sink in. And along the way, we're having conversations with different team members who are watching, and they call up, and either because of a close personal relationship or a professional relationship. And then, you know, even the personal conversations from different people that you have relationships in the industry turn to say, okay, what are you going to do about it? And I said, well, we'll wait and we'll have to figure that out type thing. So as the day goes on, you begin to shift from the hurt and anger of what happened to, okay, we're NASCAR, so we've got to make decisions.
Before worrying about the upcoming race weekends at New Hampshire Motor Speedway in Dover, the primary focus was taking care of NASCAR industry members scattered around the country on that fateful Tuesday.
And along the way, we're talking to different people in the industry almost nonstop. And, you know, you find that there's one team, I think they were in Kansas testing, and they were watching it unfold. And then we had a group of officials in Richmond, Virginia that stayed over after the Richmond race before they went to New Hampshire in Richmond to work on the rule book for 2002, which was usual for us back then to take a moment in that August-September window to work on next year's rule book. So that was all organized after Richmond, and I'd stayed up for a day or so and then came on back to Daytona Monday night. And so we had a group in Richmond at a hotel working on the rule book, and I called them up and I said, hey, you guys may need to turn on the TV because, you know, you're not far from D.C. and, you know, keep an eye on things. And then the federal government starts making decisions about ground and air traffic. So the guys in Kansas are going to have to figure out how to wrap up out there and drive back to Charlotte. And our officials in Richmond are going to have to figure out, because I was going to stop and pick up a lot of them on the way to New Hampshire. But the spirit of what you were doing, either if it was, I think, teams testing or us working on rule books, the air kind of come out of that. You said, all right, we can worry about this later. There's now something more important going on that we just don't have the heart to pay attention to what we're supposed to be doing. So, and I think that was kind of universal, that inside our industry, I know it was, but I think it was universal just talking to friends and family members that's not in the sport.
Then the attention turned to what would happen with competition, requiring conversations with the upcoming racetrack promoters, Bob and Gary Bear at New Hampshire, and Dennis McGlynn at Dover.
So you kind of step back from what you were going to do that day to evaluate what's going on. And then we got to a point, and we pick up the phone and call Gary and Bob Bear, and obviously they were interested. Different promoters would call. Dennis McGlynn, he called up from Dover. And a lot of them were inquisitive conversations. The ones that we may have called up, he says, you know, what do you know? You know, here's what we know. What do you know? And what do you think? And so we spent a lot of Tuesday talking internally, but I think more of Tuesday we spent talking to different people in the industry. And then you kind of get a read from their thinking, you know, whether it's a driver or a car owner or a crew member, crew chief, or track operator. The next one up with the Bear family in New Hampshire, and so those conversations were more constant, and they turned more from, you know, oh my God, what the world is going to happen or what has happened, and to, okay, what do we do? I think they already had campers on the property for the weekend, but they everybody got the gist of the magnitude of what 9/11 was all about. And so Gary and Bob said, look, y'all decide what you want to do, and we'll do whatever you tell us to do. So then when you start evaluating the emotions of 9/11 and all the ones that went with it, hurt, anger, fear, all those, that was one, that's a, you know, that might have been the least of the complicated parts to deal with. But it was a huge, it was way different than losing a driver at a racetrack, but which is complicated and difficult for us in the industry. This was at a whole nother level of hurt and anger. But then it becomes the logistics of it all. So you got to think, okay, this is NASCAR, and we rebound and we go and we march on. And we had people in the industry that had that attitude around it. But most of the industry felt like, hey, this is way too big. I don't have it in me to do it. I don't, you know, and I don't think my guys have it in them, or my group has it in them. So we're evaluating that tide all day long. But then when you start putting the pragmatic pieces to the logistics of aviation being grounded, not knowing what interstate systems, or particularly since we're going from the southeast through Washington, D.C., through New York City, or close by to get to New Hampshire, you don't know what those logistics are going to be like. And then you're keeping an eye on other sports leagues and other entertainment, you know, just entertainment in general. And so now you're starting making decisions around logistics more than the emotions, but the logistics are starting to play a bigger role in all that decision making.
By the time September 11th was over, it became evident that NASCAR would be taking a break from racing that weekend at New Hampshire.
I think by the end of Tuesday, we were kind of resolved with, you know, look, this, if we do New Hampshire, it's going to be a challenge, emotionally and physically. And then everybody said, all right, let's sleep on it, and then we'll get together first thing Wednesday morning. But by then, I think everybody had resolved that, okay, we're not going to do this in New Hampshire. So we had to work through the logistics of that conversation with Gary and Bob, and it impacted a lot of ticket holders that had maybe already been there or certainly planned to go to New Hampshire. But 9/11 was a different, just a whole different magnitude that had such a huge impact on everybody. So I think the spirit around figuring it out was good on everybody's part. So, but we had a lot of logistics around New Hampshire unplugging it. And then we had to say, okay, if we don't run here, do we not run it? Do we run it? And we had a full schedule all the way through to Thanksgiving weekend. So you had to figure out when that race was going to take place, if it were going to take place. And then you start thinking past all of that to where, okay, if we're not going to run this weekend, when do we run again type thing. So there was even, there could have been doubt on Tuesday or Wednesday about Dover the following weekend because its proximity to D.C. And in those areas. But the first one was to unplug New Hampshire.
NASCAR wasn't the only sports entity to make the call to postpone. The first to do so was the NFL, which once had played on the Sunday after President John F. Kennedy's assassination on November 22, 1963. That heavily criticized decision loomed in the background nearly 38 years later, as virtually every pro sports league in America announced it was on an indefinite hold beginning September 12, 2001.
Again, I go back to the magnitude of 9/11 in my lifetime. And I was around when Kennedy got shot, but I wasn't old enough to have to make decisions on anything. But that was the whole country mourned that together. I think 9/11 was even a higher level of hurt to the American spirit. And I think we all collectively mourned and were angry over what happened to the point to where what we did in sports or entertainment wasn't important. Us being respectful, paying tribute to what the families that were impacted that day, the first responders, the people in the buildings, the Pentagon, the airplanes, that trumped everything that that we would think about in our world. And I think that was the general consensus throughout the sports industry, at least, and even some of the music concerts and different things that were scheduled. I think everybody was of the same mindset. I think we began to be more confident about Dover even before we got to the weekend. It was eerie still because no airplanes flying and the skies being dark and everything, so there was still that somberness of what had happened and everything. But I think the American spirit start to kick in and say, we need something. We need a rallying point, whether it's a baseball game or a college game or a race. We need, I think all of our fans and our population was telling us that we need to go do something together. We need to go not celebrate the event, but be able to come out and say, we're back, and we're going to figure this out. It took a long time, and if we ever get back, I don't know. But I think our fans and other sports fans and the population in general just wanted something to start the process of feeling like we can do something again.
The September 23rd race at Dover became the return, though not without concerns about security. That was grounded in the track's proximity to a prominent nearby Air Force base, as well as Washington, D.C., where the Pentagon remained heavily damaged by one of the planes hijacked on September 11th. With a sellout crowd of roughly 150,000 still expected at Dover International Speedway, discussions ensued about a new level of security protocols.
Yeah, there was a lot of dialogue about, okay, do you bring the whole, because I think he was sold out at that race. And if not, by the time we started having the conversations, it filled up pretty quickly once we said we were going to go back. And so, okay, now are we capable of hosting a crowd like that? How do we do it safely, securely, the best we can do? So we had to change up some protocols. That was the first race where fans got scanned. You couldn't bring a cooler or a bag in. But they were all willing, the fans were all okay with that. They said, all right, we got it. We want to come together. And they were very flexible and very understanding of all that. And then the security around the track had to be turned up quite a bit. And there's different milestones along the way where we've learned how to do things better. And that certainly was one of them that we very quickly, there was a little bit of fear around coming back 150,000 people in a grandstand? Is that another target? Is, you know, what, and the proximity of all that happened on 9/11? So there was a host of things that we talked about, ran through our heads, but this is not just a NASCAR spirit. I think this is America's spirit, is you figure out how to do that. And we did, in a pretty quick order. I've known Dennis for a long time, and I know his spirit, and I know his patriotic beliefs. And I think his fans were of that same thought process. As we put the weekend together, they were quick to tell Dennis and us that that's the right thing to do. Let us come back. We want to be there. We want to come together and tell the world that we're very sorry for the families that were impacted about what happened, and we're angry over what happened. But this is America, and we want to come together and stand together and celebrate something together. And after all my years in this sport, I'm just so amazed and honored to be part of a community that has not just the resiliency, but the it's organic how each team thinks about, all right, this is what I'm going to do. My car is going to look like this. My driver's uniform is going to look like this. In just a matter of days, you know, they presented NASCAR in a way in Dover that made our entire industry very proudly. But they do, each individual one of them do it organically. It's not like they said, okay, you know, NASCAR didn't call up and say, all right, you paint your car like an American flag, you paint your car like this, and, you know, Cal Ripken is going to be there, it's his race, and so we didn't, that all was organic. I mean, these teams think like that, and so everything that unfolded in Dover, the teams chipped in on it just organically.
By procuring 150,000 miniature American flags to distribute through the packed grandstands, Dover President Dennis McGlynn and his staff also ensured a remarkable display of patriotism.
So Dennis said, I'm going to get flags. Is it okay if I hand them out? And I said, as long as somebody tells us we can't do it, I said, I think it'd be great. And in those days, I think MBNA was part of the Dover. And Dave Elgina, I remember Dennis said that he started calling up people. And you know, the whole world was shook by this deal. And so he was calling, trying to find that many flags, because they kind of wanted to do it. And Dennis liked the idea, and we liked the idea. Some of the funny stories where he called and whoever he was talking to thought it was some kind of a prank or something, you know, and said, well, I don't think I've got that many. So he found them. Somehow they came up with them, and was a great success of the fan being, they not only were part of the event as a fan, they now become part of the event as the tributes. And we've done them a lot since then, but that might have been the first time I've ever seen. I know some tracks have done cards and different things, but it was amazing how the energy just kind of created all of those moments that you look back now and you feel really good about.
And now please remain standing for our national anthem by Miss Tanya Tucker.
Oh, can you see by the dawn's early light, what so proudly we hailed at the twilight's last gleaming, whose broad stripes and bright stars through the perilous fight, o'er the ramparts we watched, were so gallantly streaming, and the rocket's red glare, the bombs bursting in air, gave proof through the night that our flag was still there. Oh, say does that star-spangled banner yet wave? Oh, the land of the free and the home of the brave.
sung the whole national anthem with Tanya Tucker, and you couldn't write a script to have that come together like that. You can put the pieces in there and see what happens, but all of that, it was almost as if we were shooting a movie about patriotism. But it just unfolded. But the elements of it, and the heartfelt hurt for the people that were impacted by 9/11, the first responders that got caught up in it and made their commitments to be who they are. And then it was kind of obvious that our military was going to play a role in this at some point. And so I think that's what made Dover maybe the appropriate moment, place geographically, but also gave us the ability to bring back all of the energy that exists in NASCAR anyway and turn that into a tribute to everybody that was hurting from 9/11.
The race also had a winner who seemed rather appropriate, too.
Dale Earnhardt Jr. is going to lead 193 of 400 laps. The American and checkered flags out at Dover. Earnhardt Jr. wins.
Good to be back in the race car, and I'm glad I could be the guy to win the race so I could carry the American flag around there, and that made me feel good.
So we get accused by some that we write scripts on how the race comes out and everything, which is ridiculous because we couldn't if we wanted to, and we don't even want to do that. But I think Dale Jr. winning down here in Daytona in July was therapeutic. And it was ironic that same set of shoulders that we were riding most of the year, including into Victory Lane at the 400 here in Daytona, was also the set of shoulders that gave our entire industry that winning moment in Dover. I just 2001 was as tough on Dale Jr. as it was in anybody I know in the industry, and for him to step up and play his role the way he did and do the things he accomplished, and we've talked about him, and he and I both, there's things that we can't remember. But there's a lot of things that are big moments that it's special. And him winning that race was pretty special. So post-race, I went and found Dennis McGlynn and hugged him because we had figured it out. You know, we did it. All the parts and pieces that had to be decisions made around and then orchestrate and all of it coming together, and then I went and found Dale Jr. and hugged him because those were the two characters, I think, that bookend everybody else's involvement in making that event work. Now, we were still nervous. We were still had some fear of what was going to happen next in the country. But having completed that weekend and putting the wind kind of back up underneath us was a good moment, and it felt good. But you instantly had to start thinking about, okay, we pulled this off. We got this done. Everybody came together to get this done, and it was feel good for everybody in the industry and people that were watching it. But now we gotta keep going. And so there, you know, you leave with feeling really good about how that weekend worked, but there was still a little bit of fear about, can we keep doing this and everything's going to be okay, because I know our country still felt pretty fragile there for a while, and we were the same way.
Thanks for listening to this special edition of the NASCAR and NBC podcast. We appreciate NASCAR Vice Chairman Mike Helton for sitting down with us to recall the impact of September 11th on NASCAR. And thanks to Steph Harris of NASCAR PR for helping coordinate the interview. Thanks as well to NBC Sports producer Joel Madak, whose work on the September 11th tribute feature you again can catch both online at NBCSports.com or the Motorsports on NBC YouTube channel, or during Saturday night's Cup pre-race show on NBCSN from Richmond. Coverage starts at 6:30 p.m. Eastern. The NASCAR on NBC podcast is available wherever you download podcasts. Please leave us a rating and review to help spread the word. And any feedback you can send to me on Twitter, at Nate Ryan is my handle. Thanks again for listening to the NASCAR on NBC podcast.
Reese's peanut butter cups are the greatest, but let me play devil's advocate here. Let's see. So, no, that's a good thing. that's definitely not a problem. Reese's, you did it. You stumped this charming devil.
You haven't heard about the McCrispy yet.
Well, then, you probably haven't heard the sweet silence after the first crispy bite either. Go try it for yourself to hear the best not sound you've ever heard.